I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style.
You wanted law and order in this town. You've got it.
Randy! 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 Where's the rest of me?
Those who would trade our freedom for the soup kitchen of the welfare state have told us they have a utopian solution, a peace without victory. They call their policy accommodation. And they say if we'll only avoid any direct confrontation with the enemy, he'll forget his evil ways and learn to love us.
There are cynics who say that a party platform is something that no one bothers to read and it doesn't very often amount to much. Whether it is different this time than it has ever been before, I believe the Republican Party has a platform that is a banner of bold, unmistakable colors with no pale pastel shades.
A while back along the campaign trail, I was doing a question and answer session when a little girl, couldn't have been more than 6 or 7 years old, stood up, asked a question I'd heard before, but coming from her, it threw me. She said, "Why do you want to be president?"
I will not make age an issue of this campaign. I am not going to exploit, for political purposes, my opponent's youth and inexperience.
March 30th, 1981.
Mr. President!
We hear much from Moscow about a new policy of reform and openness. Some political prisoners have been released. Some economic enterprises have been permitted to operate with greater freedom from state control. Are these the beginnings of profound changes in the Soviet state, or are they token gestures intended to raise false hopes in the West? We welcome change and openness. The advance of human liberty can only strengthen the cause of world peace. General Secretary Gorbachev, if you seek peace, if you seek prosperity for the Soviet Union and Eastern Europe, Mr. Gorbachev, tear down this wall.
Ronald Wilson Reagan, February 6, 1911 to June 5, 2004, was an American politician who served as the 40th president of the United States from 1981 to 1989.
The life of Ronald Reagan, coming soon on 10 American Presidents. I'm Chris Stewart from the History of China podcast, and I approve this message.
It was the best of time. It was the worst.
She was the people's princess.
To fight on the beaches.
Oh, Eamon, these are the things that made England.
To fight on the landing ground.
These are the things that made England.
I have the body, but of a weak and feeble woman.
These are the things that made England.
And a king of England, too.
These are the things that made England.
Cry God for Harry!
And these are the things that made England.
England! And St. George!
These are the things that made England.
Hello and welcome to The Things That Made England, the show where we discuss some of the key points of history, culture and anything else that might come to our minds that we believe can constitute something that made England what she is today.
Ooh,
concise roundup, sir.
So, this is Luke Baxter speaking to...
Royfield Brown.
And how are you this morning, Royfield?
Where I am, it's not the morning, but... No, it's the afternoon. It's very much the afternoon. I've been reading up about an ancient, forgotten, formational, foundational character of England, because I think you're going to propose him this week.
I am indeed. Mm. King Athelstan.
Hello. In his Chronicle of the English Kings, written in the 12th century, the historian William of Malmesbury says of one monarch, "The firm opinion among the English remains that no one more just or more learned ever governed the kingdom." This paragon of royal virtue is King Athelstan, who reigned for 14 years during the first half of the 10th century.
Yes, he is a bit sort of forgotten, isn't he? When I was sort of genning up for this, I did a bit of Vox Pops, finding out what people knew about. Nobody asked and heard of Athelstan, who is, you know, he is the glorious. Athelstan the glorious. The first king of England.
I think it's Athelstan the forgotten. You know, we have Ethelred the Unready and we have Athelstan the Forgotten.
It's so unfair. And, you know, victor of the great battle, you know, he's a great administrator too. So I think this is a slam dunk in the cabinet and, you know, let's move on.
Well, I think he should be in the cabinet. You're not going to have me push back against you. But as interesting as his rule is, it's why has he been forgotten? Because it's something which I've said to David before, you know, when we did the very first episode, which was 1066, those Norman kings have been so good at changing our perception of English history that, you know, all the kings starting with one, it's William the First, you know, it's Edward the First, even though there were a couple of kings called Edward beforehand and stuff. So
Athelstan's with the exception.
There you go. So there's three kings, which I think the average Brit, or the average English person, I should say, is actually heard of. Though we don't necessarily know that much about two of them. Alfred the Great, everyone's heard of him. Scones, he burnt them. Then you've got Ethelred the Unready. And we only remember his name because it sounds so ridiculous. Ethelred the Unready. King Canute.
And I don't think unready actually means what we think it means. I think it means poorly counseled or something. Yeah.
Exactly. Yeah, he didn't read. He couldn't read.
Right.
That was it. Yeah. And then we got King Canute.
Yeah.
Now, but if you were to ask the average English person, what were the singular accomplishments of any of these kings, apart from the burning of some cakes, they're going to scratch their heads. Or they're going to say, well, you know.
Attempting to push back some water, which didn't work. And also, King Canute was a Dane.
There you go.
I mean, obviously, in all of these times, that everyone basically came from the same sort of area of Northern Europe, whether they were Saxons, Jutes, Angles, Vikings, or whatever, or Normans eventually, of course, they were all the same lot.
I think, though, Luke, you should plough on with Athelstan, because I'm going to call him Athelstan the Forgotten, but by the end of it, he's going to be rediscovered, reclaimed.
Well, I very much
hope
so.
The most English of Englishmen.
Yes, indeed. obviously, where do you go if you need to do a sort of bit of background research on early Anglo-Saxon England?
I go back to the Chronicles. I go to an old dusty abbey somewhere.
Oh, right.
preferably in Norfolk.
Okay, very good.
Because my old English is very good.
Right.
I can read it in its original form.
Yeah.
Right. And that's where I go to find out about Anglo-Saxon kings of old. So,
right, so
where do you go? You're going to say Wikipedia, aren't you?
No. I'm going to say bead or nothing. No. There's only one place to go, and that is to the history of England. So David did some lovely, remodeled, recrafted versions of his early episodes. And so the ones that if you want to sort of listen in more depth to somebody who knows a lot more about this thing than I do, then I would recommend listening to episodes 9, 10, and 11, which cover Alfred the Great's death, Edward the Elder and his sister Athelfled, and then episode 11 is the one that's actually about Athelstan. And if you're really lucky, you get to hear David reading the poem of the Battle of Brunanburh, which we'll be talking about later. And you can actually get the full poem in Old English, which I'm sure is the one that you would go to immediately, Royfield. This here.
Absolutely.
I did listen to the whole thing. I'm not sure I caught a lot of it, but actually there's a There's a very good translation by Tennyson of the poem, which is very, it's a Tennyson poem, really. And that's definitely worth a listen. Let's sort of run through some of the sort of key facts. Problem is with Athelstan, and I think this actually might go some of the way to answer your point about why he is the Athelstan, the Forgotten, as you like to call him, is that we don't actually know an awful lot about him. You know, where Alfred the Great had the monk Asser, who was his sort of biographer or hagiographer, if you want to look at it like that. There is no
PR person.
Yeah, to put it into today's speak.
Spin doctor.
The Dominic Cummings. No, dear. No, sorry. So then there was no equivalent for Athelstan. So there's not the sort of written record that we could turn to in, in our old English, as good as it might be. He was born sort of 895 or thereabouts. Again, we don't know when these people were born. He died in 939 and then acceded to the throne in 924. He was crowned, and this is quite key, he was crowned king of the Anglo-Saxons and not actually as of the West Saxons, which his father was. He came from the line of Cerdic, which was the line that gave us Alfred the Great. So Athelstan was the grandson of Alfred the Great. He was the son of Edward the Elder, possibly the bastard son of Edward the Elder, again, which is something that might have caused problems. And then nephew of Athelfled, the Lady of the Mercians.
Okay, so can you give us, just remind us of how England was constituted when he was born? Obviously, I am a proud son of Birmingham, so I'm a Mercian.
You're a Mercian.
What were the other English kingdoms or provinces?
I mean, this is the end of Mercia. I thought as a proud Midlander, you might be a bit sad about that one. But the sort of basic sort of context was that the Vikings had invaded, taken over large swathes of England, right down to Wessex was the last sort of holdout, which was where Alfred the Great was from. So Alfred the Great was the king of Wessex. He wasn't the king of England or anything close to it. In fact, at one point, he was just sort of holed out in a sort of marshy area. But he reestablished the kingdom of Wessex and basically came to an agreement with the Vikings to divide the country, largely sort of running basically the Vikings were in the north and east of the country and the Anglo-Saxons had the sort of south and west of the country. That area was called Danelaw, and as the Danes were in charge of it. And so that would have comprised mostly of the ancient Anglo-Saxon kingdoms of East Anglia and Northumbria and Kent. Alfred sort of made Wessex strong again, handed over to his son, Edward the Elder, who was king of Wessex, and he was the one who retook the southern part of Danelaw. So he retook East Anglia and Kent and made London Anglo-Saxon again. While in the meantime, Athelfled, who was Edward's sister, had married the king or the Lord of Mercia. He wasn't a king, who was a client of the kings of Wessex. And so between them, between Athelfled and Edward, the Danes were basically left with just Northumbria in the northeast. And because Athelstan was possibly the bastard son of Edward, and Edward remarried another woman and had more children with her, Athelstan was banished from Wessex and had to go and stay with his aunt in Mercia. So he had very strong connections with Mercia. But on the death of Athelfled, her daughter tried to take over for a while. I mean, Athelfled is an amazing person in her own right. For a woman to be running what was considered a country was really quite amazing in the sort of 10th century. So on her death, Mercia was no longer independent and became part of Wessex. So at that stage, when Athelstan came to the throne, he was therefore crowned king of the Anglo-Saxons, whereas before he would have been king of Wessex.
So would he have had a separate coronation in Wessex and in Mercia?
No, I don't think so, because by that time, Mercia wasn't considered a kingdom. Athelflaed and her husband were the Lord and Lady of Mercia rather than the King and Queen of Mercia.
All right, gotcha.
The key thing that he did, one of the first things that he did was to take York. which was obviously called Jorvik at the time, which was the capital of Northumbria. And that's when he became the king of the English. And that was when he was really first caught. There was the concept of the king of the English.
Had there been any moves prior to have a king of all the English, the Anglish, the Angles beforehand?
No, I don't think so. I suppose it was definitely a dream of Alfred's, but I think there were sort of senior kings like Penda or Offa.
Good Mercian king.
Yeah, yep. There was all good strong Mercians in the glory days of Mercia. But, yeah, it's quite a while ago that the Midlands were the leading. Sorry, they were definitely separate kingdoms, though some of them would have been subservient to the other. Like the Kingdom of Kent. I think the Kingdom of Kent was quite a strong kingdom, but then became part of East Anglia.
Okay, gotcha. All right, so this is what, 924, did you say?
Yes, he came to the throne in 924, quite quickly moved on and took York. York had been held by a Danish lord called Sitrick, who was actually Edward the Elder's brother-in-law. And so, you know, vaguely sort of family related, but I think he died before Athelstan moved into York. And so that was the point where it really was England, and recognizably England in the geography that it is today. Cornwall is a bit of a weird one. I'd say Cornwall was sort of semi-independent, was still peopled by the Brits rather than Anglo-Saxons. The Anglo-Saxons had never really taken Cornwall. And it had a slightly different relationship. But other than Cornwall, we had the England that we would recognise today.
Mm. So how different, and this is I absolutely don't know the answer to this. So when his army rolls into York, how different culturally would York have been from, let's say, Mercia or from Wessex? Do we have any idea? Obviously, I know that these people there are English, but they've been ruled for a little time by Viking overlords, haven't they?
Yes, but I suppose the key differentiator, and I'm no expert, but the key differentiator would be religion. The Anglo-Saxons were Christian and very proudly Christian. Alfred was, you know, a very strong proponent of Christianity, as was Athelstan. And, you know, they funded churches and monks and abbeys and everything. And whereas, obviously, the Vikings were pagan. Some Vikings seem to, or Viking kings seem to have converted, but it's, I think, often for political reasons. Sitrick. So I think this Sitrick, who was in York when he married Edward's daughter, he became a Christian. But I don't think anyone's massively convinced by this.
Gotcha. So we now have a king of all the English. But Northumberland back then went all the way up to literally to Edinburgh, didn't it? It didn't quite stop on a Berwick, as we kind of understand.
Well,
it.
Well, no, there was one small. It's a bit like sort of the village of Asterix, but there was one small hangout that was still Anglo-Saxon. That was Banbrook, and I said that it was the north and the east that was handed over to the Vikings. But except for Bamburgh, which is in the very northeast and most eastern point, and that, because it's a very, very powerful, very well-defended castle, never fell to the Vikings and was always held by the Anglo-Saxons. And actually, this is something I wanted to talk about. Was, have you followed the Last Kingdom series by Bernard Cornwell?
I haven't, but I tell you what I have watched, before you come on and tell me about that. I used to watch the Vikings series.
Oh, yes. Yeah.
And seasons 2 and 3, there's a lot of messing around in Wessex.
Yeah, and Northumbria.
Yes.
Don't want to spoil it too much. Yes, so if you like the Vikings, you'll probably like the Last Kingdom series. It's basically, if you're really into shield walls, it's the go-to series. But I've been reading the books. They, to be honest, have gone on a bit. I think I'm on book 12 or something. And you kind of feel you should be wrapping it up by now. But that's all based around this guy called Uther, who is fictional. But he is the Anglo-Saxon lord of Bamburgh. And actually doing research for this for this episode has been a complete spoiler for my Last Kingdom series, because I've sort of found out that Athelstan did eventually take Bamburgh as well. So he didn't just take Danish Northumbria, he took Anglo-Saxon Northumbria. In the stories, Uther and Athelstan have an oath. And so by doing the research for this, I've seen that Athelstan's going to break his oath to Uther at some point, which is a great shame, because Uther's a dude.
I'm wondering, right, so I think we understand from school, looking back at the reign of Alfred the Great, etc., and the Dane or in the Vikings, that England was a patchwork of kingdoms. But what we don't have is this rich lore of the reconquest, of the unification, in a way that I was just reading about last week about the Spanish reconquest.
Yeah.
So what we don't have is like this, like the Spanish story of the slow driving out of the Moors. And I wonder why that is, because I didn't know about Bamburgh. You know, I have an idea of the construct of this. And I'm sure it's really down again to Billy the Conk and his descendants that, you know, they've rewritten English history so that even the, you know, the glorious, victorious ascent north of Athelstan and his armies, which starts with his father, you know, it's not part of English mythology at all.
No, I know. And it is very similar. You know, I mean, if you think of sort of Wessex as being the Asturias of the Reconquista, then there is something.
I like that little accent shift you just did then. Very authentic. Yeah.
There are definitely things in common between the two. And I don't know why we haven't mythologized it in the same way that, you know, 1066 is totally mythologized. I suppose the Alfred against the Vikings thing is that, you know, that I did a project about it when I was about 10, and I've still got my little notebook, and I loved it. One of the things I really didn't know about was the Battle of Brunanburh. And were you all over that one?
I wouldn't quite say I'm all over it, but I know it. I know of it.
So. Yeah, no, it's fantastic. So. Again, they don't quite know when it happened, but probably sort of late in the year 937. Not quite sure where is Brunanburh, but they reckon it's probably sort of in the Wirral somewhere in the northwest. And that was a classic area for Viking invasions, because there were lots of Vikings based in Ireland. So they would sail up the Mersey. And you could sail quite a long way on the Viking long boats along the Mersey. So you could penetrate really quite far into England, which is actually quite, you know, why you feel that York is going to be a long way from Dublin. But because they could sail quite a long way through, it was quite easily connected. And, you know, Athelstan being King of England and doing what Kings of England do, had quite quickly invaded both Scotland and Wales, and made the King of the Scots and the various Welsh kings, you know, kneel to him or whatever it might be. Take the knee.
Too right too, sir. Too right too.
Careful what you say.
I say that very tongue-in-cheek for the remaining constituent parts of the United Kingdom, which will not remain part of this country for too much longer.
No. My Scottish blood sort of stirs at moments like that. So they were all fairly fed up with him, and they could see that, you know, they could see the way it was going, that this guy was going to be the sort of main power, that the English were going to take over the whole island. And he had gone around calling himself the King of the Whole of Britain. Minted coins with this on it. So it was fairly clear what his plans were. A confederation of various kings. There was Constantine, the King of the Scots. This is going to be difficult to pronounce. Olaf Guthrisson, who was a Viking warlord from Dublin, and who was wanting to reestablish the Viking control of York. Owain, the king of Strathclyde. And this is a massive battle. And, you know, it's known as the Great Battle or the Great War. David, in his episode, is very clear about the fact that it was fairly inconclusive, even though it was a great English Anglo-Saxon victory. The Cornish chipped in on the side of this anti-Anglo-Saxon confederation, and this kind of seems to have been pretty much the sort of last hurrah of the Cornish as an independent people. And it really is one of the most important battles in British history. But again, it's one that we don't seem to know an awful lot about. There is an epic poem, which I think I mentioned before. There's the Anglo-Saxon version and the Tennyson version. But, you know, to be honest, it's got much more about, you know, how the sort of sun rose and then the sun sank and all the dead bodies scattered on the battlefield. It's really quite gruesome. But there's not an awful lot about the sort of actual tactics of what went on in the battle. There was a shield wall. You always got to have a shield wall and these sort of things. Yeah. Sorry.
I've always thought it was, when I think about that battle, the fact that, so you had the Irish / Vikings come over from Dublin. You had a couple of kings from Scotland, one the king of the Scots, one the king of Strathclyde. And then you have Welsh kings, princes fighting as well. And then you throw in the Cornish. The thing that's always amazed me is that how did they communicate to coordinate that all the armies were going to get there?
Yeah.
You know, it's just beggar's belief, you know, in an age where, you know, communication was at, you know, the speed of foot, right? That you have Scots coordinating with the Irish, coordinating with the Welsh and the Cornish. Oi, let's all meet up on the Mersey and let's go for the English.
And also, and getting the enemy there as well.
Yeah.
You know, to actually sort of all meet together to get this battle. Yeah, I don't know. It's amazing. Yes, and because that confederation is unusual in that, you know, Constantine, the king of the Scots, was a proud Christian, and presumably the Welsh as well, and they were teaming up with these Viking pagans, and that would have been considered a bit of a no-no, especially as I think Constantine had, you know, sworn fealty to Athelstan and so on, and so he, you know, there's some stuff about the treacherous Scot, so had to scamper from the battlefield and left his dead son on the battlefield, and they're not very complimentary about the Scots in the poem. Yes, but I think symbolically it's quite sort of quite important as a battle, because it really is where the English sort of become imperialists. You know, the sort of. And I think if we ever do an episode on the empire, which I hope we do one day, I think there's the sort of imperialist urge is quite English. I know that, you know, the Scottish were very involved in the empire and so on, but it feels like that real sort of desire to conquer comes from the English part of Britain. And this is where, to me, it's kind of started, because this is where the Anglo-Saxon, the English, were defeating and, you know, bringing to submission to the Welsh and the Scots, and to a certain extent the Irish in the Viking form. I think it's a fundamental battle in our history, one we should probably try and find out a bit more about, at least where it happened. On top of all these sort of martial glories, Athelstan was a great administrator. He brought in some very important legal reforms that particularly dealt with robbery. And he seemed to sort of really focus on robbery as a crime. But probably, you know, it was an urge for him that now, you know, after such sort of terrible times of fighting and civil wars and battles against Vikings and so on, that he was trying to bring some sort of peace to the land and to regulate the land and to make it into to somewhere that, that wasn't constantly at war with itself.
Do we have any idea how different the jurisdictions would have been in the various different bits of England?
I think we do. I wouldn't necessarily have them to hand, but yeah, that's something that, that David covers very nicely about, you know, how the shires came into being and what's the difference between the shires and the hundreds. I imagine that they would have, you know, the different sort of mini kingdoms that had been would have had their own forms of administration, and they would have tried to maintain them to a certain extent. Because, you know, looking at it from our perspective, this is the founding of England, and it feels sort of slightly inevitable that it should have happened, because it did. You know, the East Anglians would have seen that this was an invasion of the people of Wessex. I don't know how do you say that, Wessexians? No, can't be. The people of Wessex. because, you know, who were their age-old enemies. They'd been, you know, in fighting between before the Vikings had ever arrived. So it wouldn't have been seen. I mean, there might have been some sort of, at least these guys are Christians. But, you know, to a certain extent, they might not have seen them as great liberators coming to save them, because they were the enemy.
He wanted a stable kingdom. Yep. He had good governance. And he was rather pious as well, wasn't he? You kind of mentioned before that those Anglo-Saxon kings went in for a bit of God-bothering, didn't they?
Very much so.
They liked all of them.
Yeah, yeah. Yes, so he founded a number of abbeys. I think it was Malmesbury, one of his. Yes, and I think that's the other thing, that one of the key parts of Athelstan's reign is he started making sort of connections with other European Christian potentates. Mm-hmm. And I think that's quite key. And that's probably, you know, as the sort of, you know, the devastation that the Vikings brought to England and the rest of Western Europe was beginning to sort of get sorted out. I imagine that the cross-fertilization, as it were, between all of the Christian kingdoms could sort of flourish again. Athelstan never married and didn't have any children. But he was one of 13 children of Edward the Elder. And one of the key things he did was making connections with Europe by marrying off his many sisters to various European kings.
So wait a minute. Should we could now call him Athelstan the Unpotent? Because,
you're keen on giving him some fairly derogatory nicknames here. The glorious. Well, it was very handy that he didn't have any children to a certain extent, because then he could just hand on to his brothers. Because so when he came to the throne, so his mother had not married Edward, and so there was talk of the fact that he wasn't legitimate, and Edward married a second wife who was the daughter of one of the most powerful lords of Wessex. Very much a political move. And it looks like Athelstan was kind of sidelined at that point. So that's when he went up to Mercia to live with his aunt Athelfled. So Elfwyrd appears. Elfwyrd was given Wessex and Athelstan was given Mercia. But fortunately, Elfwyrd died. So that's when Mercia and Wessex were unified under Athelstan. And as I was saying, so he married off his sisters. His apparently very beautiful sister, Edith, seemed to have been slightly luckier, because she married Otto the Great, the Saxon emperor.
Oh.
Yep.
German king.
Oh, yeah. I named my son after him, actually. My son's also called Otto.
Oh, wow.
But handy name if you want to invade Europe. Athelstan's other sister, Eadgfu, I'm not quite sure how we say that, was slightly less fortunate. She got married to Charles the Simple, King of France.
Yeah, it's not a French, as French kings go. He wasn't there, was he?
No, I mean, there are a few called the Bald and the Fat and something like that, so. I suppose simple could mean it's of simple tastes. I don't know enough about it, I'm afraid.
It does not mean that. Because if it was a medieval king of simple taste, would have called him pious, wouldn't
yes,
they?
Yes,
it would have been Charles the Pious.
Yes, so they'd have loved
he was simple point. Because he just wasn't particularly clever.
just a little
call
bit.
Him as it, as
yeah,
it
yeah. And so, yes, yeah, so I think in essence, what we have here is, you know, something that is definitely a thing that made England, in the fact that he is the first king of England. He might be slightly lesser known, but I think that probably reflects.
There's no slightly about Luke. There's no slightly about it. No one's heard of him.
No one's heard of him. Well, they do now. They have now.
No one's heard of him, and it is a shame. And as I say, I blame William the Conqueror and the Plantagenets, the Normans, et al. That come afterwards, really, because it's a wonderful story of the foundation of the country. It has all the elements. It's got battles. It's got marriage.
Yeah.
It's got the slow, relentless march north to retake these territories, and it's just not part of the national consciousness. It just isn't.
No.
Yes, it's in dusty old books.
Yeah.
And it's kind of it's ironic, if that's really the word, that how it's being played back out to us is through the sagas, the stories of other nations. You know, it's like the Vikings, etc. That great series. And the Anglo-Saxon king, and I forget the name of the king who's portrayed in the Viking series, he's incredibly cultured and urbane. Yeah. And he's Machiavellian. But, he comes over as somebody of great culture.
Yeah.
And we just associate that bit of English history with blood, guts, mud huts, and not much else. And it's not right.
Yeah.
Because you look at the treasures at Sutton Hoo, and they beg a belief into the ornateness and the beauty of them. So Anglo-Saxon culture was something actually to be revered and to be admired all throughout Europe. But it's just kind of lost. And I just think Athelstan, we need to reclaim him. We really absolutely do. How we do that?
It starts here.
Really, the fight back starts here, does it?
Yeah. Well, I think actually there's a very good, there's some new Penguin books. The historian Tom Holland, he's brilliant. He's written the one on Athelstan. But these are a slight, they're not, I've sort of found one thinking, hey, great, it's going to be, like the Ladybird books. The Ladybird books of old with lots of pictures and stuff. These ones are quite text heavy. I really recommend that because he's a fan.
Do you struggle with books with lots of text in, do you, Luke?
Oh, yes. I need big space, big spaces to fit my finger through and follow the words. Yeah, I do like a picture. I think we should be reclaiming this guy who, and it's very interesting what you're saying about the culture. You know, both Athelstan and Alfred the Great were very literate, were very cultured people who really wanted to promote that whole, promote literacy. Alfred used to get really annoyed if he found out that his lords couldn't speak, couldn't read. He thought that was a key part of being an important person in the kingdom, and Athelstan was trying to sort of recreate to a certain extent the sort of cultured court of Charlemagne, from sort of 100 years before that. Charlemagne was famous for sort of trying to bring all the intellectuals of the land to his court. And actually the St. Dunstan, started his career, who had quite a key role in the future after Athelstan, but he started his career in court at the court of Athelstan, although I think they clashed quite a bit.
So he conks out in 939, yeah. Athelstan. So who takes it? What's his immediate legacy? You said that I know the Vikings grab back York and hold it for about another 20 years or so, but is that maybe another one of the reasons why he doesn't, even though he is the first king of all the English, or the king of England, he doesn't quite get the props he deserves because whatever he set in place, it got rolled back quite quickly, didn't it?
Yes. Yes. I mean, I think virtually immediately afterwards, the Vikings did retake York. So that was a very short-lived moment. And it's quite interesting to think of the dates where, you know, we're in 939 and we've got 1066. So, you know, barely 100 years later, the Normans are arriving. But that whole sort of Viking, you know, the Canute story and all of that lot has got to fit into those 100 years after Athelstan and before, before Edward the Confessor and Harold and all that lot.
And Ethelred the Unready.
And
Ethelred the Unready.
Yeah.
Hardy Canute, all those, you know, those weird and wonderful Saxon Viking kings.
Spain Forkbeard. But this is where the concept of England started. So it might have gone, it might have been reinvaded, and it was invaded by Normans. But
I don't want to split hairs. The concept of England doesn't start there, but the political reality of there being in England started there.
Right. So you think Alfred conceived it?
This isn't the first conceptual idea of an England, but it's the first political reality, because there had been Bretwelders or Bretwalders, in other words, the most powerful English king at a certain time claimed to have overlordship of other English kingdoms. And so Offa, good Mercian king, he was a Bretwelder. You know, he claimed overlordship of Sussex and Kent and even Wessex at a point. But he never had necessarily direct political control over all these different bits of the English realm, so to speak, or the realm of the English.
But I imagine in a way, they would have had something in common. They were Angles, the Saxons and the Jutes would have come over more or less the same time. They would have had something in common. And there would have been the most powerful one amongst them who would have been the Bretwalder. Some sort of king of kings. But I reckon it's because of the reconquest that does sort of forge your identity. You know, you mentioned the Spanish before. The concept of Spain didn't really exist until the Reconquista. You know, that before that had been Asturias, Galicia, León, and et cetera. And I think that is a very sort of powerful moment in forging a nation. In forging a country, is that sort of invasion. It's, you know, setting yourself against a conceived common enemy that gives you your identity.
True. But I think we might be having a semantic argument here. I see that the Spanish reconquest is different in that those Spanish kingdoms, Castile, León, Aragon, and Navarre, right? They saw themselves, what bounded them together was that they were Christian against the Muslim horde.
Yes, but the same thing.
But with the Bretwalder, there was a concept of an overlordship of all of the English, and it was a concept. Whereas Castile and León, they get united through marriage. It wasn't a case of the Castilians and people from León said, you know what, wouldn't it be great if one day all of the Iberian Peninsula was one Christian kingdom? There were competing Christian kingdoms. There was never an idea of overlordship.
I would have to check that, because they were the Vandals. No, they weren't Vandals. What were they?
Visigoths.
They're Visigoths. And so whether they, as Visigoths, they would have had some sort of common bound, and whether there was some sort of king of kings of the Visigoths, I don't know. But I do know that they, you know, that they fought against each other. You know, the story of El Cid is
like rats in a bag.
Yeah,
they were terrible.
They were fighting alongside the Moors as much as they were fighting alongside their fellow Christians.
Absolutely, and that's in large part the reason why the Moors hung on for the hundreds of years that they did, because these Christian kingdoms were going at it with each other all the time.
Yeah.
Anyway, this is the history of England, not the history of Spain. of Iberian Spain. So shall we pause and just say, why don't we check out what's happening on the social media roundup in terms of, because I'm sure I've got stunning plaudits from everybody for my majestic sweep of the history of the Bank of England. Absolutely. I like that good wordplay from the Bank of England. It was richly deserved. Thank you for that, Luke.
I'm here all night. Yeah.
Hello, Angley. Fiona Powell here with the social media roundup. The old lady of Threadneedle Street, or the Bank of England. Roy Field proposed it, and Luke was an excellent foil, providing us with additional information. Before I launch into the roundup, may I make bold and nudge Roy Field on the shoulder a little? You called it the Daddy Bank, Roy Field. Surely, as she's the old lady, she should be Mummy Bank. Roy Field outlined rather well the connection between the bank and the slave trade, and I thought you might like to know that William Wilberforce teamed up in 1787 with Thomas Clarkson and others, including an amazing and often forgotten woman called Hannah More. My other little nudge to Roy Field is to say, Roy Field, 16-whatever, Plymouth Rock and all that. Oh dear. 1607, first Jamestown colony, Virginia, three ships, Susan Constant, Godspeed and Discovery, although it wasn't the first colony, but we haven't time to discuss Roanoke. Apropos of nothing, in 1618, a Welshman called Thomas Powell ventured to Jamestown to give it a go. His giving it a go didn't work out very well. Anyway, he was my eighth great-grandfather. December 1620, Plymouth Colony, Massachusetts, the Pilgrims, the Mayflower, and all that. And alas, they too enslaved people, not only from Africa, but Native Americans as well. In August of 1682, the Welcome sailed from Deal in Kent with William Penn and a bunch of Quakers to the new Commonwealth of Pennsylvania. No slavery allowed. Luke posted a link to a wonderful article on why the Bank of England is called the Old Lady of Threadneedle Street. Duncan Dix said, "Sterling episode. Roy Field cashes in on David's absence," to coin a phrase. "I really felt I got my money's worth. It's a banker." Michelle Gerrish began with a very fine argument. She said, "This might be the first time I didn't vote for something to go into the cabinet. Roy Field did a very nice job with the history, and I would definitely put it in the British cabinet, but not the English. And on an emotional level, it just doesn't stir up warm feelings for England, like, say, H.P. Sauce or the Archers or 1066 does. But I have two questions. One, are you sure there are bars of gold in the vault and not rolls of toilet paper?" And here's where she shot herself in the foot. Two, when do sheep get to go in the cabinet? Oh, Michelle, you began brilliantly and then you broke my heart. And your punishment is that you are coming with me to Wales to gaze upon sheep. Holly Martin said, "I think this is the first time I fully bought Roy Field's argument hook, line and sinker for financing the Navy alone. This belongs in the cabinet." Bill Debbie Pendleton began with, "While on board as a whole, I beg to differ with the slight disparagement of the British Army during the Napoleonic Wars." He then went on with quite a fascinating post, which really stirred the pot, that entire thread regarding the Bank of England, battles, Banks of England. It's all worth reading. Do check it out. Marilyn Little ended that thread with, "I agree it has to go in because of all of the reasons noted above. It was, after all, established in 1694 before England embarked on the union with Scotland, so I'll take it as ours. Rowena Card thought it was a good episode and agreed about it being cabinet-worthy. Then she was worried about missing the vote. You didn't miss the vote, Rowena. We wouldn't let you. I deliberately waited until we were all ready before preparing the roundup. Or I could procrastinate for Wales if we had our own team in the Olympics. Pick your own favourite excuse. Including Rowena, 64 people voted for the Bank of England to go into the cabinet. 7 people deemed it not cabinet worthy. There is a lot of activity on the Facebook page. We've got Daleks roaming around Whitby, and as someone who knows the town well, I'm not in the least bit surprised. Chocolate oranges and sheep and sheep and more sheep and football and sheep and Halifax in the 1920s. Tune in, turn on and comment. And until we meet again, this old lady who's not from anywhere near London says, stay safe, stay well.
And thank you very much for that excellent roundup. And I think we can call it a day with Athelstan safely in the cabinet. And looking forward to the next show, which will be in a couple of weeks from now, I hope.
Yes, absolutely. Don't know what we're going to talk about yet, but I'll bring my A game, I know that. But what we do want to hear from you, though, listener, is why do you think Athelstan has been overlooked in the annals of the English national consciousness? Why is it that this the first of all Englishmen, so to speak, has just been negated and neglected in terms of anybody's idea of really what constitutes the country? You know, he isn't a great heroic figure. In, you know, there aren't BBC One documentaries or dramas about him reconstructing his life. Though there have been about his grandpops, Alfred the Great.
Indeed.
So why not? And Luke said, it starts here. You know, we're going to reclaim him here. So why don't you start that good fight on our Facebook page? Go there and tell us how we can reclaim and big up First King of all the English.
Excellent.
Thank you, Mr. Baxter. You give me an education, sir.
Thank you. This is great fun. Thank you very much. Speak soon.
Bye-bye.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.